This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, January 15th. I'm Hannah Colton. Thanks for joining us. Coming up this week, a conversation with Bryce Edgman before he heads to Juneau for the start of session next week.
The budget deficit at this point, I think, is being viewed by legislative leadership and probably the majority of legislators as needing to be addressed by taking budget cuts first. And any attempts to generate new revenue would be sort of secondary or even put off, I think, until next session.
A Dillingham entrepreneur gets financial backing to grow lettuce in water inside a 40-foot reefer van.
The lighting is all LED, and it has a bit of a spaceship feel when you get in there. There's blue lights and red lights.
And Bethel's abuzz as mushers and their teams prepare for a slightly icy Kuskokwim 300 race.
We got some snow a few days ago, which kind of helped put some traction out there. But it's icy enough that the race committee decided to change the race trail.
Those stories and more are coming up after a brief look back at some of the week's news. A government watchdog determined the EPA was unbiased in evaluating the potential impacts of the Pebble Mine. The Inspector General report released Wednesday essentially cleared the EPA of wrongdoing in its work related to the Bristol Bay watershed assessment. EPA Region 10 Administrator Dennis McLaren, in a rare interview, praised the IG's findings.
They did do a very robust review of the communications back and forth, the correspondence. They did interviews. They looked at emails from a wide array of EPA employees and other folks, including folks outside of EPA.
But Pebble CEO Tom Collier said that was too narrow, calling the OIG's report a whitewash and an embarrassment.
To be only 30-something pages long, to not cite any of the really significant documents, it's just an outrage.
The report wasn't all rosy for EPA. It did cite issues related to the role of former EPA ecologist, the now absentee Phil North. Still, anti-Pebble activists are thrilled, but it's unclear what difference the IG report will make in the ongoing battle between Pebble and EPA. That will likely be decided down the road in federal court or left to the next administration. Dillingham police this week nabbed two heroin dealers. 37-year-old Joshua Rivera was caught with a large amount of heroin and thousands in cash in a Nurkel Loop residence. Chief Dan Pasquarello said the department used a confidential informant to make a buy where Rivera had set up shop after flying in from Anchorage.
We don't just pull in our net as soon as we see a splash in it, because then you only catch one dealer. Lots of times we like to let the net soak, catch more dealers.
Rivera is being held on $50,000 bail. And a second bust on Tuesday caught 22-year-old Chelsea Sam, who police found selling one dose of heroin. She was also charged with a felony and faces 5 to 8 years of jail time if convicted. President Obama Tuesday gave his final State of the Union address, and Alaska's congressional delegation didn't much like it. One sore spot for Senator Dan Sullivan was a passage urging a faster move away from fuels like oil and coal.
I don't know what more costs the president can impose on the energy sector in Alaska, but when our, you know, state is struggling with fiscal challenges and layoffs, that certainly was not a good message to hear from the president of the United States.
Sullivan and Murkowski also took issue with Obama's positive assessment of global security and national defense. On the plus side, Murkowski did say that Obama seemed to land more jokes than usual. Bristol Bay had a break from rain and sleet storms this week as a chilly, dry spell settled on the region. But the National Weather Service warns the cold's not here to stay.
This pattern does not look to be changing too much. The ridge out east over the panhandle remains pretty stout and in place, and with a trough out to the west, we essentially continue to see storms moving in from the south, bringing in warm air for the foreseeable future.
In local basketball news, last week both Dillingham teams had a rough start to their seasons, losing two games each to the Bristol Bay Angels. This weekend, the boys are down on the Kenai Peninsula for Nikiski's tip-off tournament. They lost to Nikiski 72-20 Thursday night. The Wolverines will take on Bethel Friday and face Homer Saturday afternoon. Meanwhile, at home, the middle school and JV seasons are kicking off with matches against Aleknagik and Manicotic. In other news, Senator Lisa Murkowski threatened to block the appointment of the next FDA commissioner over the issue of labeling GE salmon. the National Army Guard visited Bethel. A Holy Cross man was locked up for attacking a woman for several hours. And the MAP School in Dillingham graduated its 100th student. More on this week's news can be found at our website, as always, kdlg.org. Alaska's legislature will gavel back into session next Tuesday. As the price of oil continues to drop and the budget deficit continues to grow, many are expecting these next 3 months to serve as a uniquely important chapter in Alaska's history. Will lawmakers attempt to cut our way out of the deficit or seek out new revenue sources like earnings from the PFD and new taxes as proposed by the governor? Bryce Edgman represents District 37 and sat down this week with KDLG's Dave Benninger to discuss what's to come.
Here we go. Next week, back to work for you. What are some of your priorities as you go into this, what we think will be a kind of a contentious session?
That's a very interesting question, because last year, I think when we did this interview at this time, my priorities were different than they were this year. Last year, I think I was able to kind of look ahead and feel pretty comfortable about protecting programs that were important to District 37, as well as maybe coming home with at least a small share of the pie in the capital budget. This year, that outlook has really changed, and I'm going down with more a sense of doing everything I can to make whatever budget reductions, and there will be budget reductions that are incurred, to make them as judicious as possible to the, you know, the long list of programs and services that we in rural Alaska have come to depend on. The budget deficit down there at this point, I think, is being viewed by legislative leadership and probably the majority of legislators as needing to be addressed by taking budget cuts first, and any attempts to generate new revenue would be sort of secondary or even put off, I think, until next session.
How do you feel about Walker's idea of more taxes and making use of the permanent fund earnings to pay for government?
Well, first, I would say I applaud the governor for being bold. He actually put politics aside and put a package forward that, as he was quoted saying, would irritate everybody equally. But it's a package that looks at both reducing the budget, but also bringing in new sources of revenue. Now, anytime you talk about new sources of revenue, that's where you get in the area of making painful decisions and making people angry because you're goring their ox. Now, in terms of particulars of his budget proposal, that's something that I, as a member of the House Finance Committee, will be immediately absorbed in, basically from the moment I get down to Juneau till we pass the operating budget out of the House more towards the middle of session.
What's changed since the last time we talked, in your mind?
Well, what I think has changed is that we've seen the Senate president talk about sales taxes in an email that he apparently sent out to all the majority members. We've seen the House Speaker make public pronouncements that we simply can't cut our way to sustainable budgets. And to me, those are sort of hints that we're sort of moving in the right direction of looking at this problem in its totality. Not, again, just cutting the budget, but also looking at having to bring more money in from other sources in order to stave off of these wholesale budget reductions, which really are going to hammer smaller communities like Dillingham and the Bristol Bay Borough and everywhere in the district.
Okay. Bryce, something else that's come up quite a bit in conversations around town is the idea that our Dillingham District Attorney's Office is slated to be closed. We've lost the prosecutor now. It doesn't look like that position will be refilled before the office is scheduled to be closed. But you say that's not necessarily a done deal to you.
No, it's not a done deal. And I can't tell you how disappointed I am that the Department of Law would make a decision that to me is penny wise and pound foolish. I'm going to meet once again with the governor and the attorney general when I get to Juneau. That's going to be one of my first order of businesses. And I'm going to remind them of the conversation we had last spring when I basically got a commitment from both of them to keep the DA office here in Dillingham open. And I want to remind them of the importance that the DA plays in the overall framework of criminal justice services in the Bristol Bay region. But I want to talk to them about the costs. I want to ask them if they've analyzed what it's not only going to cost this region in terms of this from the service aspect, but what it's going to what the distributional costs are going to be to the other sister criminal justice agencies, because I can bet you that that cost is going to be a lot more over time than the $340,000, $50,000, or $60,000
right around there
DA position would save.
Okay. Let me ask you something else. There were allegations raised last week from the Association of Village Council Presidents of the misuse of TANF funds. What was your reaction to that story? Were you surprised by that?
Well, I was very surprised when I heard the announcement in late December, and it definitely raised eyebrows. Severe reductions in pay for senior staff and for others in the organization. No explained reason, just sort of a quick blurb in the paper, if you will, or on the radio about it. And apparently the rest of the story is coming out now. Like many others, I have no idea what the true internal workings are involved with that. But I'd have to say that it did, I've known Myron Anning and others at AVCP for many years. I've worked with him hand in glove on a lot of rural issues. I have a lot of respect for him. But that story probably doesn't go away anytime soon.
Bryce Edgman, thanks so much.
Dave, as a closing comment, I might, as I do every year, encourage everyone to get signed up to our electronic newsletter. We send it out every Friday. And then as well, you know, if people want to call the office, please do so. And they can certainly find me by emailing me, Googling and so forth. But we're down there to serve people in the region. And, you know, we look forward to interacting with as many people as possible.
And I'm sure that we'll have you back as a regular guest of our legislative call-in show. We'll not get that started next week, but the week following we'll pick that up. So appreciate your time as always, Bryce, and good luck down in Juneau.
Thank you, Dave. Keep up the good work. Appreciate it.
Bristol Bay and beyond. Now, many diligent farmers have found Bristol Bay to be a fertile land and proudly brought its fruits to market. That is between the months of June and about August. But now one entrepreneur hopes to extend our slim growing season by taking the crops inside, specifically inside a shipping container built by the Anchorage-based Vertical Harvest Hydroponics. Dillingham's Kyle Bleck received an investment by the Bristol Bay Development Fund to start his venture. And he came to the studio this week to tell us about it. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
So before we get into your newest venture, can you give a bit about your background farming here in Dillingham?
Well, we bought our place on Waskey Road a while back, and I did want to sell things locally at the farmer's market. And I found that that there were challenges in harvesting time, and you know, a lot of times I was coming back from the farmer's market and having to throw things to the chickens and such. And so I kind of decided that, you know, selling at the farmer's markets just maybe wasn't the best thing for our family and kind of with all the other things we had going on. And so we backed off of the farmer's markets and just concentrated on growing for ourselves. And that's what we've been doing the last few years. So getting this containerized growing unit is kind of our reentry into the commercial sales.
So the Bristol Bay Development Fund kind of pitched you this idea to have a hydroponic farm. Did they put you in contact with the hydroponics company in Anchorage?
Yep.
Tell me about that company and their technology.
What really sold me on them was we were having conversations, and last summer, Dan Perpich said, well, you know, I'd like to just come out and meet you guys and see Dillingham. And so he did. He got on a plane, came out to our place, and he met me and Johanna and the family and walked around the garden and put a fire in the fire pit and barbecued and, you know, just had some beers and just talked. You know, him being willing to come out here and meet us and see the community really made a difference to me, because that's something that, you know, as a lifelong rural Alaskan, it really gets under my skin when folks think that they can just, you know, shoot these great ideas out of Anchorage, and folks in rural Alaska will almost have an obligation to accept them. But that's not how these guys operate. They want to get involved. They've got incredible expertise. And they want to make this thing work. They want to be a genuine partner.
Okay, so can you describe how the system actually works inside the container van?
Yeah, so they're rounding up old, used 40-foot insulated reefer vans, and they're retrofitting them. And essentially, there are two rooms, more or less. There's one small room right when you walk in, And in there is a large water reservoir and the nutrient reservoir and a little starting area. There's a heater there. And then all the controls for the ventilation and the heating and the water. And then the majority of the unit is just shelves of, you know, hydroponic growing trays. It's just those white trays with the little square in it. And you just have the water and the nutrients being pumped below, and you've got the plant growing above. The lighting is all LED, and it has a bit of a spaceship feel when you get in there. There's blue lights and red lights and such.
So these outfitted reefer vans, what does it cost to run?
The biggest cost is the electricity. The water at our house is good enough, so we don't need to import water from anywhere. And the seeds are, seeds are pretty cheap. And then there's a cost with the nutrients. But it works out that you can produce enough and you can sell it at a reasonable price and make a profit.
So I know BBDF kind of asked you to do your due diligence, check out the market around here. What were you hearing from folks at grocery stores and restaurants?
Well, folks are pretty excited about it. There are lots of challenges to trying to sell or offer lettuce and fresh greens, thousands of miles from where it was grown. People we talked about, how much waste and spoilage they have with their lettuce and greens, and we can just eliminate that. People can be eating salads that are just a mere hours old and in February and March and December, and we've just never had that option. In fact, a lot of the fresh greens that we can grow, they aren't offered at the stores because they just don't travel well enough. So folks are generally pretty excited and pretty agreeable. The other thing is that we're not limited in the types of lettuce varieties we can grow. A lot of folks don't even realize how much yummy lettuce there are, that lettuce can have flavor. So, folks are very receptive. Some of the stores, not all the stores are able to buy from us and sell just because of their corporate policies. But in general, there was a lot of energy. People liked it. And so between now and our first sales, we'll be going back to those folks and finding out exactly how many heads that they want and they need.
So you did find at least some buyers who said, yes, we will buy your lettuce or your greens?
Yeah, we found a lot of buyers. Yeah, yeah.
You said, greens can have flavor. What are you most excited to be growing?
One of the unique things about the hydroponics is that when you harvest this head of lettuce, you can pull it out and you've got the roots. You can wrap the roots around the stem of the plant, and then you can put that in a container, be it a plastic clamshell or just a plastic bag. And you put it in there, you put a little water in the bottom, and the plant will stay alive. So the plant can be on the shelf and still living. So you can actually bring home a live head of lettuce, not one that's been dead and dipped in chemicals, for the last 2 weeks. So just the freshness of lettuce is going to be exciting. But then there's a whole another range of stuff that we can produce, and it's just going to depend on if people have a taste for it. We can do kale, collards, bok choy, pak choy, tatsoi, and then there's even more that we can do. And so we'll definitely be leading with the lettuce, but I do want to offer these other products to folks and just to see if they enjoy it, because these are all things that we grow at our home garden in the summers, and we just love it. There's nothing like having some good collard greens with your pork chops, that's for sure.
All right. Well, what's your timeline looking like? When are we going to be seeing your fresh salads in Dillingham?
Well, we'll this unit will be on the first barge. Like I said, it'll be built this spring and it'll be on the first barge. And we're hoping to have a product available sometime in June. It's just going to be a matter of how quickly we can get it going, how quickly we can get things moving. But we should have stuff available this summer. Yeah.
Well, Kyle Bleck, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Take me outside, sit in the green garden. Nobody out there, but it's okay now. Bathe in the sunlight, don't mind if rain falls. Take me outside, sit in the green garden.
A couple of weeks ago, a couple dozen people with little better to do on a Saturday counted birds around the area. They did so as part of the annual Christmas Bird Count, which gathers data from thousands of participants around North America in what's billed as the longest-running citizen science survey in the U.S. What birds turn up in the counts, or don't, can sometimes tell us a little more about what's happening with our weather or climate, and is sometimes just interesting to know. The Dillingham Count Circle had 23 participants, with 13 watching feeders, the other 10 heading out afield. Their preliminary tally is 14 species and 789 total birds. Susanna Henry compiled the data.
We had nothing really earth-shattering, but we had some nice numbers. 240 ravens, for example, 22 white-winged crossbills, one American robin that was spotted by the Nelson Party. I was glad for that. 13 red-breasted nuthatches. Andrew Slagle spent a lot of time looking at the Wood River right at Snag Point and right at the outfall for the water treatment, and was able to see 110 common mergansers and 58 red-breasted mergansers there. So I really appreciate his efforts.
On the east side, Melissa Cady compiled data from the roughly dozen participants in the King Salmon Counting Circle.
We had a really interesting count this year. We had a really high species diversity, way higher than we've ever recorded. We had 24 species. The next highest count we've ever had in the last 30 years was 18 species, and we've had 18 species several times. But, we increased our species diversity by quite a bit this year. That being said, we didn't have any new species. They were all species we've seen here before. Our count total was a little bit low. We had 848 birds counted this year. The average over the last 30 years has been 1,394 birds. And what really stood out to me this year was we had a large number of raptors detected.
Those included a sharp-shinned hawk, northern goshawk, and a boreal owl. Cady says the number of waterfowl in the King Salmon count was down. Waterfowl in the King Salmon count was down, maybe on account of snow blocking drivability down to the river. Some common murres were counted, which is new for the Christmas bird count, and there were other notable mentions, too.
We had a golden-crowned sparrow, which normally we don't see at this time of year, and we have had some Pacific wrens seen in the area, but we actually didn't catch them on count week, but we were hoping to. And those normally wouldn't be here at that time of year, so those were kind of interesting.
Further down the Alaska Peninsula, the Cold Bay count often beefs up the Southwest Alaska tally with the addition of waterfowl species wintering at Eisenbeck Refuge. KDLG's Dave Benninger spoke to this year's lone participant from there.
I'm Ken Richardson, and I'm the pilot at Eisenbeck.
And you say you were the only one that was out there that day.
That is correct. You know, we had a lot of people on leave, and the weather was pretty marginal that day, but we didn't have any volunteers this year.
Richardson counted 23 species, including 150 emperor geese, 1,500 Pacific black brant, and dozens of various ducks. He also tallied snow buntings, willow ptarmigan, pelagic cormorants, and a jeer falcon.
I was worried that I wasn't going to see the emperor geese, and normally we have a pretty big population of emperor geese here at this time of the year. But we did find them. I didn't see a snowy owl, and normally I'll find one or two snowy owls, but could be that I just couldn't see them because the visibility was down. But all in all, I think we found probably what we expected to find.
Falcon's a good spot, isn't it?
Yep, jeer falcon was. You know, it's a good find. You know, sometimes we'll find a peregrine falcon, but I didn't see a peregrine this year.
The Audubon Society says the data collected by observers over the past century allows researchers, biologists, and other interested individuals to study the long-term health and status of bird populations across North America. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, back in a moment.
I'm gonna quit these rambling ways one of these days soon.
The famed Kuskokwim 300 sled dog race kicks off this evening in Bethel. Longtime musher and KYUK reporter Angela Denning is there covering the race and called in to give us a preview of the action. Angela, thanks for joining us.
You bet.
So you've covered many races there in the YK Delta region, as well as raced many times there. Big question on probably a lot of people's mind, what's the trail looking like?
Well, this year, like the last few years, it's pretty icy. Certainly down on the lower end of the race trail near Bethel. We got some snow a few days ago, which kind of helped put some traction out there, but it's icy enough that the race committee decided on Wednesday to change the race trail. So the first 50 miles, instead of being on the Kuskokwim River, mushers will be jumping up on the riverbank and then heading overland for the first 50 miles. Then it will continue on the more traditional race route. And then the last 50 miles will trace back that overland trail to the finish line. And that's because it will give mushers a better trail. It'll be a tundra trail. There'll be some lakes and sloughs, but more snow is caught up on the tundra at this point than on the river. It's pretty icy.
All right. What about the competitors? Who seem to be the people to watch this year?
Well, as usual, there's several big Iditarod Yukon Quest names, the most competitive mushers in the world. In terms of distance racing, we have, returning Iditarod champions, Lance Mackey, Jeff King, Martin Boozer, his son Roan Boozer, Paul Gephardt, just to name a few of them, are here this year. Last year's champion, Bethel's homegrown Pete Kaiser, of course, is racing again. He won last year. So it'll be highly competitive. Also, John Baker, a former champion from Kotzebue. He's in the mix as well. There are 33 teams registered to race, but we just heard from race headquarters that they think there's probably 26 that'll start on Friday night. Mushers have just withdrawn before the race for various reasons, as happens usually every year.
Okay. Anyone coming in brand new or any other locals?
There are some rookies in the race this year, as well as some other locals. There's a rookie from Nome, Diana Hecker. Patrick Mackey is signed on. I heard he may or may not make it to the start line. He, of course, comes from the Mackey family, and there were five different Mackey teams signed on to run this year's Kuskokwim 300 Sled Dog Race. Lance Mackey, Jason Mackey, his brother, and then Patrick Mackey is Jason's son, and then there's also Brenda Mackey, Rick Mackey's daughter. Rick Mackey is a former Iditarod champion himself. So, yeah, so it should be an interesting race. A lot of veterans, a few rookies, and very highly competitive again.
Is there a fan favorite, or what's the buzz around town there today as we get closer to the end of the week?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard to say. I mean, locally, I think the fans usually root for the homegrown, so that would be Pete Kaiser of Bethel. There's also Mike Williams Jr. from Aquiac, which is 30 miles upriver from Bethel, and then Richie Deal from Aniak, which is on the Kuskokwim, 150 miles upriver from Bethel. So those three often have a good fan following just because they're all three Iditarod mushers. They're very successful mushers, but they're also just local Kuskokwim guys. That said, you know, Brent Sass will be here. He's last year's Yukon Quest champion. He has a huge fan following. And then all of those other Iditarod mushers that I mentioned, they have thousands of people following them and their careers on the race trail. So it could be anyone's race. It just depends on a lot of variables, how their dog teams look this year. And a lot of them look really, really good. You know, little things can make a big difference. We heard that Brent Sass lost a lead dog this week. We don't know the reason why, but his lead dog died. We hope to talk to him about that coming up in an interview. But things like that can really change the whole entire race for a musher. So at this point, I think it's anybody's race, and we'll just have to see how it looks come Friday.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to your coverage of that and look forward to following that progress of the K300. When does it get started?
The race starts Friday night at 6:30, and it follows a sister race. Now, there's two other races happening this weekend along with the K300. They're considered sister races. So there's the Bogus Creek 150 and the Aquiac Dash. The Bogus Creek 150 starts at 5 p.m. The K300 main event will be at 6:30 p.m. And then Saturday at 2 p.m., the Aquiac Dash will start. And that means that It's a racing weekend because the Bogus Creek Mushers will finish sometime Saturday morning. Then the Dash will run at 2 o'clock. Those mushers will finish Saturday night. And then the K300 mushers will start to roll in back to the finish line probably sometime early Sunday. And then they'll be trickling in most of that day.
Sounds like an exciting full weekend. Thank you so much for giving us a preview, Angela Denning.
My pleasure. It was my pleasure.
And that's it for this week's show. You can find this and past episodes of Bristol Band Beyond at our website, kdlg.org. Do keep in touch with us. We really appreciate the feedback and story ideas. I'm Hannah Colton, in for Dave Benninger. We hope to see you back here next week.